But it's not enough to just say, oh, there's bad news for Republicans. Isn't that great? We've got to get out there and we've got to get active. We've got to do something. We've got to be proactive. In fact, it's not even just about this election. It's about the entire process. Jefferson Smith in Oregon is the director of the Bus Project, busproject.org. He's executive director of the Bus Project. Busproject.org is their website. And Jefferson is one of the people who, in the United States, in this country, to the best of my knowledge, frankly, probably the most successful person in this country at organizing young people. Jefferson is in the studio with us. Jefferson, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom, really, really great to have you. I've listened to National Show, also your local show. I think it's wonderful stuff. I think you do a great job.
Well, we were talking a few minutes ago, and you were talking about how nationwide the stats show that young people actually are not registering in the numbers we had hoped.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen ever since 1972, ever since 18-year-olds got the vote, that the participation of the young voters has decreased in every election since, with two exceptions. One exception was the first Clinton election, which was the first year of Rock the Vote, and the second was this most recent election with John Kerry versus George W. Bush, in which more resources were put into investing in the youth vote than any election otherwise. So what we noticed from that election was that if you focus on young voters, they'll vote. You can actually have a significant delta, a significant increase in voter participation if you focus on it. But if you don't focus on it, the overall kind of me-first culture, I don't think it's something special about young people. I just think maybe older voters are maybe lagging indicators. I mean, the young people reflect the current zeitgeist of 30 years of tearing down public structures and arguing against civic participation. And I think it's hitting young people harder than it's hitting anybody else.
Yeah. So, however, on the other hand, something quite different has happened here in Oregon.
Yeah. I mean, we still have lots of work to do in getting young people engaged and registering voters. But one of the interesting numbers that we saw was not just the voter participation number, but was the percentage of young people who volunteer. And 25% to 42%. You know, nearly 40% in most of the studies of young people aged 16 to 25 will volunteer for something over the course of a year. Right? They're involved in something, but only 2 to 3% will volunteer for a political candidate or a political cause. They'll clean a beach, but they won't support a candidate who required the beach to be kept clean. Mm. And so what we did was, instead of just asking young people to vote, we went and asked young people to volunteer, to participate.
In the political process.
In the political process. Not just clean a beach, but in fact, right?
Pass a law about keeping the beach clean.
Exactly. Yeah. And here we have a public beach law in Oregon, right? And my impression is if public beach law came up in the current legislature, it wouldn't have a chance. You'd be accused of being a communist. And it turns out it's good public policy. It makes everybody get a chance to be on the beach. But what we did is we bought a bus. And we filled that bus up with young people, and we drove it around to the closest state legislative races we could find. And we did the most effective thing you can do, which isn't TV, it's not radio. Those can reach a lot of people. But to persuade an individual voter, best thing you can do is face-to-face, person-to-person, door-to-door contact.
Shoe leather.
And you know, we were told volunteerism was dead by a high-ranking political operative here in Oregon. And you know, we didn't think it was dead. Maybe it needed an ambulance, you know, maybe a bus. But we went out.
Smelling salts, that's all.
Exactly. We had a plan to go on about 10 bus trips, knock on about 30,000 doors, and they were right. We didn't do that. We went on about 14 trips, knocked on about 70,000 doors. After two election cycles, we knocked on over 150,000 doors, supporting 10 state Senate candidates, and 9 of them won. And we didn't send any mail. We didn't do any TV, but, you know.
And these were not people who were expected to win in the first place.
All of those candidates were in tight races, decided within 10%, with one exception that ended up being, you know, further away. Three or four of those races were decided by one-ninth the number of doors we hit. Three or four of those races were decided by one-fifth the number of doors we hit. So we weren't the reason.
But we were a significant chunk of it.
We were a but-for reason why, you know, 3 to 7 of those candidates won. And the important thing about that isn't about the bus project. The important thing about that is it let the volunteers know that the work they were doing was having a significant impact on the state.
I think one of the really cool things that you've done with the bus project here in Oregon, and I know you just had a big success down in Lane County. We're on the air in KOPT down there in Eugene, Oregon, as well, is getting people involved. But there's also this thing about community. I think community is one of the things that is missing in America. It's frankly one of the reasons why we have gangs. You know, gangs are dysfunctional communities. They're communities in places where there's no social infrastructure for community, so community evolves. A lot of young people will join the military just to have a sense of community. And what you with the Bus Project have done so successfully is created community around politics. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things that we talked about from the very beginning. That, I mean, our feeling is that democracy requires benevolent irrationality, right? I mean, it doesn't, you know, it requires good people doing good things for no good reason. Mm-hmm. I know that if I drive an SUV, it has no impact on the air I breathe or the water I drink. But if everybody does it, we're screwed, right? Mm-hmm. So I have to process that somehow. And one of the best ways to encourage that benevolent irrationality is through community, is with being around other people, is with positive peer pressure. And we read a book in the early days of the bus called Bowling Alone, which is about bowling leagues in the United States, written by a guy named Robert Putnam.
Sure.
Turns out more people bowl now than 1950. You know, it's not surprising there's more people now than there were in 1950. But there are fewer leagues. And the leagues there are fewer teams. The teams there are. Right.
Community America is dying, whether it's the Moose or the Elks or the VFW or the Bowling League. And in large part because half of it is that people are worked to death.
Right.
We've seen the death of the middle class since Reagan declared war on the middle class.
Right.
And the other half of it is we're entertained to death. We have 500 channels and we sit and watch them.
Yeah. Another one that Bowling Alone pointed out that I hadn't considered was the birth of the jet engine. It was in 1973, a flight across the Atlantic Ocean was the same price as a year at Harvard Law School. Right now, a flight across the Atlantic Ocean, it was both about $1,000. Now, a flight across the Atlantic Ocean is still around $1,000. A year at Harvard Law School is about $26,000, right? And so it used to be, and it had never even occurred to me before what impact that would have on community. But now, when a family has a three-day weekend, they don't visit their neighbors. They don't visit their aunts and uncles who live, you know, the next town. They go to Paris or they go to, you know, Gresham. If you're with me, you know, you go to Gresham. I don't know. Nobody knows where Gresham is. It's in my town. I just think it's funny to go to Gresham. But you know, you go to Florida, you go to California, you go to Disneyland, Disney World,
or you drive somewhere far away.
The birth of jet engine was a piece of that. So we recognize that if we wanted to save communities, we should build one, and we should build the kind of culture that encouraged people to manifest, you know, doing good things for no good reason. And then over time, if we can do that, and I think some of the only other kind of intellectual thought, the academic thought, I should say, on that is that part of why I think those structures were torn down, why the community went away, was also that some of those old institutions were racist, sexist, exclusionary. And I think that now we need to build up a new set of institutions. But the thing I would say to a lot of people out there is look for places you can manifest community, particularly where it has impact on political results.
Right. And you did that around a bus.
Exactly.
You know, we get together and get on the bus.
Literally and figuratively.
People can do this all over the country.
Yes.
And just go to busproject.org and rip it off.
Yeah, please.
It's a great
steal
idea.
It.
Steal this idea.
Buses are cheap. They really are. You can get a bus for like 10 grand. You can get a cheap one for like three. Get your friends. Go out, knock on some doors, register some voters. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and bring young people together to do it. It's marvelous. Jefferson Smith, the executive director of the Bus Project. Busproject.org is the website. Amazing work you're doing here in the Pacific Northwest, and I would love to see this replicated all over the United States. It's a marvelous model that you've built over the years, and now you're even expanding into a whole other bunch of other realms.
Yeah, there's a lot of ripple effects. I don't want to bore your listeners, but they can check it out.
It's all over at busproject.org. Check it out. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back. August von Hayek was wrong. More about that in just a second. Welcome back to listener-supported radio at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Why do we say listener-supported? Because this program, like, frankly, all talk radio, but in particular progressive talk radio, is supported by our listeners supporting our sponsors. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example. They're having a fall sale right now. If you just type the word fall, F-A-L-L, into the checkout coupon field, and when you check out from sacredgroundscoffee.com, you'll get a 15% discount. And let's see, what are we drinking here today? This is Cafe Femenino Peru, Peruvian French roast, certified organic and fair trade coffee. It doesn't get any better than this. It is absolutely mind-bogglingly delicious. Sacredgroundscoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532, the telephone number. Welcome back to our program. And apologies for the funny noises that you heard in the first few minutes of the show, technical weirdnesses that were getting sorted out. I didn't know what was going on, but we just learned about it. Life goes on. Ford Motor Company, extending their buyouts and shutdown of plants. Offer may extend to all U.S. plants. This is from the Detroit News. Ford Motor Company is weighing a major expansion of its attrition program for hourly workers. In other words, kicking out hourly workers. The original plan was to cut 25 to 30,000 jobs. This is not aggressive enough, they say. They're now cutting 30,000 factory jobs by 2012, but many analysts still think they're moving too slowly, and maybe 34,000 jobs should go. And, you know, this is, yeah. Now, they did not say whether this is going to include Canada or Mexico. In Canada, of course, they don't have the health care costs that they have here, and in Mexico, they don't have the labor costs that they have here. So you can thank Thomas Friedman and these guys for this as well. And this is where we get to Friedrich von Hayek. Friedrich August von Hayek, also known as Friedrich Hayek by some folks. But he was born Austrian. He lived he died in Freiburg, in fact, in 1992. Austrian-born economist. He won the 1974 Nobel Prize in Economics. And his basic theory was that if you simply leave the economy alone, if government doesn't intervene in the economy, that everything will be just fine. That things will sort themselves out. That there'll be, you know, rapid solutions to problems and all this sort of thing. In fact, in 1950, he left the London School of Economics and went to the University of Chicago, where, along with Milton Friedman, he became and Leo Strauss and all these guys, he became part of this cabal of the founding thinkers, essentially, of today's economic conservatives, ranging from Bill Clinton to George W. Bush. And he said, for example, that the efficient, this is from his book, The Use of Knowledge in Society, 1945. He said that, you know, the price mechanism serves to share and synchronize local and personal knowledge. So, you know, in other words, he called this a self-organizing system of voluntary cooperation. Right. In other words, free markets, everything will work out. There's an automatic price mechanism. It sounds good. It really sounds good. But there's a few things that it doesn't take into consideration. For example, how do you price fish? How do you price fish? You got a bunch of fish out there, and you got fishermen going out and getting the fish and bringing them in. And, okay, you would think that the price would reflect the cost of the fish, of the gas to run the boat, the cost of the boat, the labor to go out and get them, the cost of the fish hooks or the fish nets. I mean, you add up all those costs, and then you toss in enough profit for all these people, the distribution, the processing, all that kind of stuff. These are all the costs of fish, right? And so let's say that the fish is worth, just arbitrarily, $1 a pound. So that's the price of fish. Sounds right. That's what the free market would define. But there's a problem. Whenever you catch a fish, you're reducing future generations of fish. There are baby fish that are not going to happen because that fish got caught. If it was a female fish, it might have hundreds of thousands of eggs in it. If it's a male fish that can fertilize the eggs, when you catch the fish, you're killing off the next generation of fish if you catch in large quantities. And that price of fish that I was talking about, where we say, okay, you know, what's the price of it, doesn't include the cost of maintaining future generations. So you reach the point where you've taken all the fish at $1 a pound. Well, they're going to get scarcer and scarcer, and the price is going to start going up. But it may well never, and in fact, history shows that in many cases, I mean, we have a bunch of species that have, for all practical purposes, gone extinct. It may well never reach the point where it's so high that it will cause that species to rebound. So what do you do? Well, these are the kind of situations. You know, what about the planet Earth? We're burning carbon in our cars. If this is going to cause billions or trillions of dollars worth of damage to the world in the form of hurricanes and global warming and desertification, what should the price of oil be? Isn't there a point at which we the people should collectively say, you know, there are costs that are not part of the free market? And we need to consider these costs and build them in. We need to do it with a permitting process where people are paying extra for a permit that then goes to restock the fish, or a carbon sequestering cost where you put out 1,000 tons of carbon, we're going to pull 1,000 tons of carbon out of the atmosphere, something like that. But it even goes beyond that. And I got to tell you about an amazing study that completely debunks Hayek right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight sources.
helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, quick heads up on two events coming up. Tomorrow night, Tuesday night, in Portland, for our listeners in the Pacific Northwest, Al Gore's coming to the Rose Gardens Theater, The Clouds. I will be introducing him and moderating a question and answer panel, period with Al Gore that follows his presentation on global warming. And for those who are interested, the tickets are available at Safeway stores in the Portland area with the Rose Quarter box office, which is can be reached online at rosequarter.com or by calling 877-789-ROSE, R-O-S-E. That's me and Al Gore. And then Friday, October 27th, Friday of this week, at the University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium, Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, local progressive comedian Johnny Steele, and I will be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys, the debate moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown. And that's put on by Quake Radio, quakeradio.com, the Quake in San Francisco, KQKE, AM 960, Progressive Talk Radio there. Quakeradio.com, the website to download free tickets. And, yes, you have to have the free ticket in order to show up. So go to quakeradio.com and print one out for yourself and print out a couple for your friends. And make sure that they're coming, huh? You know, because they are trying to get some kind of a sense of who's going to be there. But the more we can get on our side, the larger the cheering team and all the finer that'll be. So, anyhow, I was talking about, I realize this may sound a little didactic, and but it's not. This is the most important stuff. When you get it, that the reason that abortion and the reason that gay marriage and the reason that you know this whole spectrum of weird ballot initiatives are out there, and that the Republicans and the war in Iraq and everything else, all these things that the Republicans are doing, have at their core an economic agenda. That these are all means to gain power for economic conservatives, because they really and truly believe Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and Tom Friedman, they really believe these guys that the world is flat and that markets should be, quote, free, end quote, and that everything will work out as a result of it. History demonstrates they're wrong. Read any book by Charles Dickens about Victorian-era England. Look at the history of the United States. During the time when we had the highest income tax, 90% top marginal tax rate. Now, granted, you had to earn about $2 to $3 million a year before you even started paying that rate in today's dollars. But nonetheless, during the time when we had the highest marginal tax rates in the United States and the strongest social safety net and strongest unionization, that was the time we had the strongest middle class. And if you go back and you look at the late 1800s, at the era of the robber barons, and the second corporate regime, the period from 1922 until 1932, when the corporations ruled America, and the Supreme Court threw out child labor laws, threw out maximum hour laws, you know, time and a half laws, threw out the 6-day work week at the time, the 50-hour work week, said all this stuff is an unconstitutional violation of the right to contract. Government should not involve itself in the private marketplace. Threw out rights to unionize, threw out early versions of Medicare and Social Security. The Supreme Court, starting with the Lochner decision in 1905, all the way up to 1937. Supreme Court throwing all these things out. That was the time when the middle class was the most devastated. And the wealthy were the wealthiest in America. We had a new aristocracy. We had reinvented British aristocracy. The aristocracy that we fought a revolution against. So this is not academic stuff. This is not, you know, Econ 101. Gee, let's sit in a classroom and learn about Friedrich von Hayek. No, this is real stuff that affects your life and mine on an ongoing basis day to day. And here's where this is what it's all leading up to. There's a study that's published in the October 16th issue of Scientific American. You can read it over on scientificamerican.com or, you know, obviously even better, pick up the magazine. The title of it is The Social Welfare State Beyond Ideology. And then the subtitle, are higher taxes and strong social safety nets antagonistic to a prosperous market economy? The evidence is now in. See, what Hayek and Friedman and all of these conservative economists have been arguing for the better part of 1,000 years, but I mean, you know, really, in a so-called scientific way, Hayek won the 1947 Nobel Prize in Economics. By the way, Frederick Nobel, as I recall, Fritz Nobel, the guy who started the Nobel Prize, the guy who invented dynamite, he did not want there to be a Nobel Prize for economics. So a bunch of economists got together and basically created their own, and they kind of shoehorned it into there. But in any case, so Hayek won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1974, excuse me, I keep saying 47, in 1974, for this kind of thinking, for the 1974 version of Tom Friedman. So Scientific American said, nobody's ever looked at this. Is it true that if you don't mess with the economy, if government does not involve itself in the economy, that things get better? I mean, we've got this old debate that goes back to the New Deal, frankly, where you've got Republicans going, big government, bad thing. Look at the Soviet Union. Big government, that's communism, that's bad. And you've got, so we want small government. And then you've got, the American people saying, we would like Social Security. We would like the government to defend our right to unionize. We would like the government to make sure that corporations are not polluting the water that we're drinking or the air that we're breathing. And we would like government to make sure that the food we're eating is safe and that the drugs we take are actually effective, that we're not being hustled by the drug manufacturers. Oh, but that's big government, say the conservatives. You must be a big government liberal. As if that's a dirty word. And liberals and progressives historically have said, and we would like a social safety net in the United States so that there are not hungry among us. I mean, literally hungry. Some 20 million people in the United States don't, at some point in any given 3-month period, literally do not know where their next day's food is going to come from. So finally somebody sat down and said, let's do the science on this. We've got enough societies now that have been big government social welfare states, primarily the Scandinavian countries. They looked at Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. And we've got enough countries that have become free market, in quotes, countries since 1980, between Reagan in the United States, Maggie Thatcher in in the United Kingdom, the continuing rightward drift in Canada, Australia, you got John Howard there now, Ireland, and even New Zealand has moved to the right. Economically. So let's just compare these. And here's what they came up with. I'll just share. This is just a couple paragraphs from this article in Scientific American. Most of the debate in the U.S. is clouded by vested interests and by ideology, they point out. Yet there is now a rich empirical record to judge these issues scientifically. The evidence may be found by comparing a group of relatively free market economies that have low to moderate rates of taxation and social outlays. That's Australia, Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, the UK, and the US, with a group of social welfare states that have high rates of taxation and social outlays. That's Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. Now, what the Bushes of the world, what the Friedmans of the world, both Milton and Thomas, would have you believe is that our economies must be in better shape than their economies. From a business point of view, our economies must be in better shape than their economies. Because, after all, we have lower taxes and less government regulation. So they looked at these. And what they found was the budgetary outlays, sure enough, for social purposes, average around 27% of gross domestic product. In other words, about a quarter of the entire output of a nation in the Nordic countries goes to social purposes. And only 17% in the English-speaking country was the average. Okay, so that's what we would expect. So what's the result of this? On average, the Nordic countries outperform the Anglo-Saxon ones on most measures of economic performance. Poverty rates are much lower there. National income per working age population is on average higher. Unemployment rates are roughly the same, just slightly higher in the Nordic countries. The budget situation is stronger in the Nordic group with larger surpluses as a share of GDP. How do they do it? The Nordic countries maintain their dynamism despite high taxation in several ways. Most importantly, they spend lavishly on research and development and higher education. You can go to college for free in these countries. All of them, but especially Sweden and Finland, have taken to the sweeping revolution in information and communications technology and leveraged it to gain global competitiveness. Sweden now spends nearly 4% of GDP on R&D, the highest ratio in the world. On average, the Nordic nations spend 3% of GDP on R&D compared to 2% in the English-speaking countries. And it's amazing. We have, these English-speaking countries have an average poverty rate of 12.6%. In the Nordic countries, 5.6%. R&D as a percentage of spending, ours is 1.8, theirs is 3. 45 minutes past the hour.
Open to everything, happy and sad. Seeing the good when it's all going bad. Seeing the sun when I can't really see. Hoping the sun will at least look at me. Focus on everything better today. All that I needed I never could say. Hold on to people that slipping away. Hold on to people that slipping away.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. And I'm telling you, it's not the elections. It's not the leaders. It's the people. That's a whole nother rant for a whole nother time. But, yeah, maybe the Democrats will take the House this time. Wouldn't that be great? Maybe not. It's important to vote. It's important to get active. It's important to get out there. And the most important thing is to activate, to energize individual people, to talk to your friends, to talk to your relatives, to talk to people at work, to wake them up. So anyhow, just to wrap this thing up, this piece in Scientific American where they compared the Nordic countries where they spend about twice as much on social welfare as we do here in the United States. 27% of their GDP versus 18% or 17% here. Almost, not quite, but almost, we pay, yeah, not quite twice as much, but close. And what they found here, just to wrap this thing up, labor market policies pay low-skilled and otherwise difficult-to-employ individuals to work in the service sector. In other words, there's a decent minimum wage for people who are not going to become rocket scientists. So if you're just flipping burgers, you're still not in poverty in these countries. Labor market policies pay low-skilled and otherwise difficult-to-employ individuals to work in the service sector in key quality-of-life areas such as child care, health, and support for the elderly and disabled. The result for the households at the bottom of the income distribution are astoundingly good, especially in contrast to the mean-spirited neglect that now passes for American social policy. This is in Scientific American. The U.S. spends less than almost all rich countries on social services for the poor and disabled, and it gets what it pays for, the highest poverty rate among the rich countries and an exploding prison population. Actually, by shunning public spending on health, the U.S. gets much less than it pays for because its dependence on private health care has led to a ramshackle system that yields mediocre results at a very high cost. Von Hayek was wrong. I'm reading from Scientific American. Von Hayek was wrong. In strong and vibrant democracies, a generous social welfare state is not a road to serfdom, but rather a road to fairness, economic equality, and international competitiveness. And yet still we've got the cons out there saying, well, what little of the social safety net that Franklin Roosevelt put into place, they want to destroy.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Joe in New York City. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Joe? Tom.
Yeah, you're live and on the air.
How you doing? Well, I'm saying the problem, one of the problems is it's not a social safety net now. It's become a social state. It's a bed now. People are laying in it. if they just don't get out anymore.
People are not laying in the bed if they're making a decent wage. The best anti-poverty program is also the best welfare program, and that's a job. And that's what the Scandinavian countries are doing. They're giving people jobs, but they're making sure that if they work, they actually are part of the middle class. And that gives those people more disposable income. And guess what happens when people who have 100% of their income, when people spend 100% of their income and they have a decent income? They create demand that stimulates the economy.
Absolutely, and that's you're 100% right. The problem is, and what I'm seeing, you're saying that how you want to, in this country, you're basically bashing the country, how we got to raise taxes.
I am not bashing our country. That's how we're holding our country up to its highest ideals, Joe.
Can I finish? You're saying, like, we had the highest prosperity and when we had high taxes, right? This is what you're saying. We did. We have a high prosperity when we have high taxes.
We did.
So you want to give your hard-earned money to a government that I'm sure that you can't trust, right? We can't trust.
Let me ask you a question, Joe. Just stick around here for a second. Let me ask you a question.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's say that you're making, I have no idea what you're making, and I don't want to get into personal stuff with you, but let's just say you're making $50,000 a year before taxes, okay? Just for the sake of argument. That means you're probably taking home $30,000 a year, right? Paying about 20% in taxes, more or less.
Yeah.
Okay. So your employer knows right now that you will work for $30,000 in your pocket, right?
Okay.
So if your tax rate went to zero, how much do you think?
Say that again? I didn't hear that.
If George W. Bush was able to reduce your taxes to zero, if Grover Norquist totally drowned government in a bathtub, there were no social programs, your tax rate went to zero.
Okay.
How much money do you think your employer is now going to offer you to work for him?
Not going to allow me.
Well, no. I mean, my point is, he knows you'll work for $30,000. Your taxes are now zero. You think he's going to keep paying you 50? No, he's going to drop your pay to 30. Because you'll work for. That's what the market has defined you're willing to work for. You don't get it. All these guys who say, it's your money, they're taking our taxes. The fact of the matter is that the market adjusts for taxes.
Listen, of course you need taxes. That's not the point. Of course you need to take a certain percentage of your taxes. And you have to pay for programs. What I'm saying is, you have a government that you can't trust, right? God forbid, you know, this guy making $50,000.
No, I have a government. I have an administration I don't trust, but I have a government that is a government of, by, and for the people in the United States. This is not the Soviet Union yet.
No, you're missing the whole point here.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Joe, you know, if you want to continue the conversation, because, you know, it's a great conversation. I have a guest at the top of the next hour. We're going to be talking to William Simpson. He wrote a book about Prince Pandar. Right after that, give me a call, and we'll get into it in the second segment of the second hour, if you want. And you know, any other callers who want to get into this, because I think economics, you got to get it. Economics is at the core of it all. It's all about the rich getting richer. The middle class getting poorer, and there ultimately being no middle class, because that works best for conservatives, because then you don't have people who feel politically empowered who are going to say, hey, wait a minute, you want to send me where to fight who? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, who's really running the show, as it were, in the Bush White House? Could it be that Prince Bandar bin Sultan has something to do with teaching George W. Bush a lesson or three about the way the world works, for example? This is just really the smallest little tip of the iceberg. William Simpson has written a brilliant new biography of Prince Bandar bin Sultan. It's called The Prince, The Secret Story of the World's Most Intriguing Royal. And William Simpson, the book is published by HarperCollins, harpercollins.com, the website for more information on the book. William Simpson, welcome to the program.
I'm pleased to be here.
Very glad to have you with us. Here we have a man who is the illegitimate son of a member of the royal family who is now arguably one of the most powerful men in the world. How did that happen?
I think it was an accident of fate, and it only happened because, as you rightly mentioned, he was the illegitimate son of a member of the royal family. In fact, his mother was a slave girl who became a one-parent family, effectively, for about 8 years. When he first met his father, when he was about eight years old, but his grandmother had recognized, and this was the wife, favorite wife of the king, recognized something about this child that was very growing up with female influences over his early years, I think has helped create a character which is rather different than the stereotype image that we would have for a member of the royal family.
He's more thoughtful, he's socially more functional.
I think that he is naturally charismatic, and that certainly helps in giving the edge in any situation. And I think the other thing that has helped in his upbringing was that he went to college in the United Kingdom initially, where he trained to be a pilot, which is where I met him. I was a college mate of his for 2.5 years. He then went into the United States quite frequently when he was training to be a pilot with help from the United States Air Force. So he developed a westernized perspective on life during that time. And in fact, you may know he's also a great fan of the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
But that gave him a broader aspect on life that he might have received if he remained in Saudi Arabia.
He's often referred to as Bandar Bush by the Bush family and by people outside the Bush family. And there have been recent reports that back in 1999 and 2000, well, in fact, for years preceding that, in fact, George W. Bush would turn to Prince Bandar for specific information. In fact, in Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, he talks about how George W. Bush went to Bandar and said, you know, why should I care about the Palestinians? Or why should I care about, you know, tell me about the Qataris? Or, you know, basically that Bandar was his tutor, if I have this right, if my memory is correct, on foreign policy.
You're absolutely correct. I read that aspect of Bob Woodward's book. And when you actually think about it, it does make a lot of sense in that Bandar had developed a very strong relationship with successive presidents since he first appeared on the scene in Washington, particularly with Ronald Reagan, where he helped support the Ronald Reagan doctrine, the anti-communist doctrine, and ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But if I skip over that, during that period, he developed a closer relationship with the vice president, then George H.W. Bush. It was natural then when he went on to the George H.W. Bush's administration and you had the Gulf War, that the relationship between the two should be even tighter. But it was helped by the fact that both were ex-fighter pilots. Mm-hmm. Now, over the last 2.5 decades that he was ambassador in the U.S., he had built a strong relationship with each successive president, regardless of his administration. Mm-hmm. Same with Bill Clinton. But the relationship with George H.W. Bush is the one that really clicked because of their common background as fighter pilots. And given the element of trust that's existed with every administration, Bandar's a straight talker, but he also understands both the culture in the West and the culture in the East. So he's a perfect bridge.
Yeah. Plus, Bandar, in terms of what he had in common with George Herbert Walker Bush, is that they were both essentially the descendants of royalty.
One dynasty to another, perhaps.
Yeah, okay. Politically and financially.
Well, I think that's your judgment. I'm looking at this as an English spectator from the outside.
Sure.
But I think that for me, the common core that they had was simply being fighter jocks together. Mm. That started it, but also that element of trust. Reagan during the Reagan days, there was so much going on that involved Bandler, and George Bush would have seen that both as director of the CIA and then subsequently as vice president. That trust has been transmitted down the line for every president, including Bill Clinton, right the way through to the current president. So it wasn't unnatural that if you're looking to give a president who perhaps lacked, or a potential president who perhaps lacked experience in the world overseas, and particularly in the Middle East, then you'd call on someone that you could trust that would give them the messages that were coming out of the Middle East. And that's exactly what Bandler has been doing for the last 25 years and is still doing it today.
William Simpson, you've written a largely favorable biography of Prince Bandar, at least from what of it I've read. I've read a good chunk of the book, but certainly not the whole thing.
I would just say to you that I did write a biography, which is natural. I knew the guy very well as a young man. I hadn't met him for 30 years thereafter. But I think if you actually ask Bandar what he thought of the book, I think he might take issue that it was largely favorable. There are bits that I'm sure he doesn't like, but equally I'm sure there are many pieces that he would like.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your take on this one particular irony. Osama bin Laden, some years ago, I believe it was in the late 90s, 96, 97, essentially said to the United States that he was going to attack us because we still had men and women based in Saudi Arabia at the, is it the Bandar bin Sultan Air Force Base? Is
that, yes, amongst others.
As a consequence of the 1991 Gulf War, and that we were propping up the Saudi royal regime, which he had some problems with, but his biggest problem was that they were keeping the price of oil low and thus the wealth of the sacred wealth of the sacred land of Saudi Arabia was being given away to the West for $10, $20 a barrel when he thought it should be at least $80 and maybe as much as $200 a barrel. Now, George W. Bush has pulled our troops out of Saudi Arabia and the price of oil is back up. It seems like Osama bin Laden, who's now still free, got absolutely everything he wanted out of the deal. Plus, he got to be a rock star for much of the world. And I'm curious what your take is on that and what role Bandar may have played in that.
Well, I think that you've got to look back at where it all started. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States has always, since 1945, since Roosevelt's meeting with Ibn Saud, has always been based on oil for security. Oil for the West at good, reasonable prices, and security for the kingdom. And that card was called in 1991 when we went to war on behalf of Saudi Arabia in facing off with Saddam Hussein. But that wasn't something that was just in the interest of Saudi Arabia. It was in the interest of the United States to basically save the oil fields coming into Saddam Hussein's control. Sure. Otherwise, we would have had a very different history. Now, since then, the Saudi take on it has been, and again, all administrations have benefited to a certain extent, they have worked to keep the price of oil at a price which would benefit the American economy, would not lead to the sort of stagflation that we had in the late Carter years and so on. And that is in Saudi Arabia's interests as well. So the Osama bin Laden bit, you've got to remember that Osama bin Laden, a Saudi and a disaffected Saudi, was actually supported by both the CIA and by Saudi Arabia because he was leading
in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Against the Soviets.
Yeah. Unfortunately, both the CIA and Saudi will throw their hands up now and say, yeah, we made a mistake because we forgot about these guys that were fighting a war and they were looking now for another enemy. And Osama bin Laden in particular had this this perception that America was, if you like, sitting on Saudi soil, and this was a bad thing. However, he overlooks the fact that, in fact, the whole reason that American troops came into the region was because of the Iranian threat and the overthrow of Iran and the Iran-Iraq war. So it wasn't something that was a deliberate policy on part of America. It was a decision taken because of the actions of Saddam Hussein.
Fascinating. Very quick question. We only have 5 seconds left. Is the Saudi royal family going to stand?
That question is often asked repeatedly. I can't see any threat to it at the current time, certainly from my perspective.
William Simpson, his new book from HarperCollins, harpercollins.com, The Prince, The Secret Story of the World's Most Intriguing Royal Prince, Bandar Bin Salman. Mr. Simpson, thank you for being with us today.
That's very kind. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your it.
Ain't it a hoot when somebody writes a song based on one of your slogans?
Giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging a war.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. It's really what it, yep, indeed, stainless steel. I don't know, maybe it's just plated with stainless steel, I don't know. Here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, on the Willamette River, also known as Portland, Oregon. Thanks for joining us again. It was an interesting break there to talk about Bandar Bush. It was interesting to get his take on it. The book is a rather lavish and friendly look at Bush, at Bandar, at Prince Bandar. But I think it is useful for us to understand, you know, what's going on with some of the world's most powerful people. And you know, this is a family. I mean, the House of Saud, this is a family that has transferred over $1 billion to the Bush family and businesses associated with the Bush family over the last 35 years. So it's not like this is some small thing. Anyway, I want to get back to the economic piece of this. I mean, there's a lot of other news that we're going to get into today as well. But just this whole idea that Von Hayek and that Milton Friedman and that Thomas Friedman, you know, this old, tired idea that Victorian-era economics, that the economics of the 17th and 18th centuries of England, of the last 6,000 or 7,000 years in large part, that the trickle-down theory, you know, if Louis and his wife simply eat enough, then and Marie Antoinette simply eat enough good stuff, then the crumbs, the cake. See, back in those days when you baked bread, the stuff that bubbled over the edge and fell off the edge, you know, the of the baking pan onto the thing, it was called cake. It's referred to as cake. Let them eat the cake. That if you just do that, then the crumbs, you know, there'll be enough crumbs that the common people will be just fine. But that from the progressive worldview, from in the liberal worldview, there's this idea that we should have a state that a government that involves itself in the economy to the extent that business is told it is the will of we the people that if you are going to do business, you're going to do it in a way that if somebody plays by the game, plays by the rules of the game, and they put in their honest 40-hour week, that they can actually raise their children and don't have to worry about being wiped out by illness, and don't have to be worried about being wiped out by old age and dying from hypothermia in the winter or hunger in the summer. That if they put in their 40 hours a week throughout the productive years of their life, regardless of how they do it, whether they do it as a physician or, and I'm not saying everything should be equalized, but my point is whether they do it as a physician or whether they do it as a guy flipping burgers, that at some base minimum, they can have a decent life. And here now in Scientific American, Jeffrey Sachs, the professor from Harvard University, as I recall, has you know, laid this thing out. The Von Hayek was wrong. The cons are wrong. It's been proven. It's no longer a debate. It's just no longer a debate. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom. Where am I? I didn't expect to get on this quickly.
Well, let's get to it, because there's other folks who want to get,
well,
who want to get on the line.
I just got back. If you don't mind, I just had a tooth pulled. So I think.
Well, I'll tell you what, Gary. I'm going to put you on hold, and you can organize your thoughts. Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. First, a quick comment. I've already voted absentee, and it was much more fun marking against each candidate individually than voting straight party. It was very relaxing, a lot of fun. Secondly,
were you able to make sure that you were still on the voter rolls?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. We try to be pretty watchful. Kind of a philosophical question, because you always talk about, I haven't seen your book yet, but you talk about the power of individual action. I look at, like, worst-case scenario, so I'll put it to you this way. If the regime there never changed and we never got Kyoto and government, I guess as far as impact on the environment, what we can do, do we have to have treaties like Kyoto, if individuals make individual choice, can we still get where we need to go? And on the flip side, if individuals don't make the choices I think we need to make, even with Kyoto and treaties, will it make a difference?
Really good questions, and let me dig into that when we come back from this break, Larry, because you've set up a perfect rant, and I appreciate it. We'll get into that on the other side of the break. Right now, time for our progressive pop quiz. Our question, who is George Bush's tutor on foreign policy? Sixth caller gets a copy of Screwed. Oh, man. In fact, it's a strange month. That's a strange year. It's been actually six of them, hasn't it? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Congratulations. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, who was George Bush's tutor on foreign policy? And congratulations to Sean Adams in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, congratulations. Sean is listening on KSAC in Sacramento, and he knew that the correct answer was Bandar bin Sultan, also known as Prince Bandar, also known as Bandar Bush. And Sean wins a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the American Middle Class, or Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It, my new book. And somebody called to say that Jeffrey Sachs is at Columbia University, not Harvard. Thank you very much. I didn't have that. Somehow that third page of this thing got bounced, got lost. So anyhow, in response to our last caller, the question that he raised, if I correctly understand and remember it, is not dissimilar from the issue that I raised at the very beginning with fish. You know, the whole issue of fish, which was a great example that at the Bioneers Conference this weekend, I frankly and unfortunately don't remember who it was who said it, but somebody used that as an example. I think it might have been Anna LaPay. Of, you know, what do you do when the cost of, when there are externalized costs that aren't included in the price of a product? In other words, how much should that fish cost if you were to say, okay, we're going to allow people to take fish out only at a rate that is sustainable? So how do you do that? Do you do it by permits? Do you do it by only allowing a certain amount of fishing? Do you do it by raising the price and charging a tax and then using some of that tax to either to reduce demand so that you're back down to a sustainable catch, or to restock the fisheries? Probably the former is better than the latter, because usually when we get involved in natural biological processes, we screw things up anyway. I mean, look at what's happening with the salmon fisheries now up off the coast of Nova Scotia. They're getting infested with sea lice, these farm-fed salmon, and the sea lice, which are typically in the Atlantic, not the Pacific, are killing off the Pacific salmon, wild salmon, as they come out of the rivers and go out to the ocean. So in any case, how do you do that? How do you monetize that? We need a new kind of economics. We need a new understanding of economics. because the commons now have become far more extensive than just, oh, it's the local pasture. I mean, this goes beyond the writing of the Tragedy of the Commons by Jeremy, what's his name? It is now, for example, if the emissions from my tailpipe are contributing to global warming, and global warming is going to cost the world, say, $2 trillion in terms of lost productivity, lost usable land, the death of people, whatever. I mean, how do you even calculate that stuff? But let's just say for a moment, for the sake of argument, it's calculatable. Let's say it's going to cost $2 trillion. How do I pay part of that? Who and to whom do I pay it? And how do they do something with that money? I mean, do you plant trees with it? I mean, trees is, frankly, a fine thing. It's a good thing to have trees. Trees build soil. Trees maintain climate in healthy ways. You know, downwind from trees, you have rain because trees actually evaporate more moisture than open water does. Because the leaves, get more warmed up by the sun and they aggressively evaporate water, whereas open oceans, frankly, don't evaporate a lot of water. I mean, they evaporate water, but nowhere near on an acre per acre basis. You know, a tree will evaporate more water than 40, 50 acres of ocean. The ocean's also colder. So, trees are good things, but they're lousy carbon sequesterers because, yeah, they pull the carbon out of the atmosphere, and isn't that a fine thing? But, 200 years down the road, that tree is going to die. And what's going to happen? That carbon's going to go back into the atmosphere. It's going to rot, and the carbon dioxide will be re-released, or it's going to be burned, and the carbon dioxide will be re-released. So it's not permanent sequestration. It's not permanent stashing away of carbon. So how do you strip that carbon out of the atmosphere? Or how do you make sure that it doesn't go in the first place? Do you do it with a permitting process? Do you build the cost in? Should you say, okay, a gallon of gas costs $3. But the damage that the use of that gallon of gas is going to do to the planet is another $3. So we're going to charge $6 a gallon for gas. And that $3 of tax is going to go to help mitigate the damage. Whether it's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere or whether it's figuring out how to come up with alternative energy sources so we don't have to have the carbon. I mean, that's basically what the Europeans have been doing and the Japanese for the better part of 10 or 15 years. I mean, they look at this and go, oh, this is common sense. And we look at it and go, what? The government interfere in the marketplace? How dare they? We've got a free market system here. And this is what Columbia's Jeffrey Sachs points out, is that, we have a free market system, and it's killing us. It's killing us. We have the lowest spending on social welfare of the industrialized world, and therefore, and it used to be just thought it was a coincidence, but now we know, no, therefore, we have the highest rate of incarceration of people in prisons. We have the highest rate of poverty. We have the highest rate of unemployed persons. It's like right off the scale. Conservative economics doesn't work unless you're incredibly wealthy. If you're in the top 1%, conservative economics is fine. If you want to create a society that is essentially a kingdom, if you want to create a society that is essentially royalty, then conservative economics works. But otherwise, no. I'm sorry. It doesn't. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
How are you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Well, I had a question for you, more or less. I usually make statements and then ask for your concurrence or whatever. But on this particular situation, you seem to be somewhat familiar with the medical industry, are you?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
I've worked around the edges of it for years.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. I'm taking a relatively... mild drug, and I won't even pronounce it. It's got a lot of syllables in it. It's for hypertension or high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on it for 30 years, pretty much on the same dosage. And lately, the doctor that I've been seeing, of course, he's now in a co-op. They don't even operate independently anymore. They operate with other doctors, like a law firm.
Sure.
And he's insisting that I come in, not very often, but with me, it's kind of an issue because he's pretty far away from where I live, and I don't have my own automobile, and transportation has been an issue. The amount for the office call has gone up, and rather than, you know, keep refilling my prescription, he insists that I come in. Now, the ostensible reason for this is he says, according to the medical ethics, he has to do that.
Yeah.
I'm just cynical enough to believe that what they're really trying to do is get me to come in so they can charge me for an office call. Am I wrong?
I'm assuming what you're taking is a beta blocker or something like that, one of the old-fashioned.
It's called hydrochlorothiazide.
Yeah. Well, without getting into the medical part of it, because I can't, you know, obviously medical advice on the radio, and I'm not Dr. Dean Adell.
Sure.
We're seeing this, yes, right across the board, and what you're seeing is that the definition of medical ethics is changing. you know, come see me every month or come see me every 2 or 3 months instead of every 6 months for things like that. My wife has hypothyroidism, which is the most common condition among women in America. Synthroid is the most widely prescribed drug in America. It's the artificial thyroid hormone. And frankly,
my mother takes that.
Yeah. And frankly, I suspect this is because of the nuclear tests back in the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Really?
That covered America with radioactive iodine, and it got into the cows, it got into the grass, it got into the cows, it got into the milk, and you got an entire generation whose thyroids were nuked because radioactive iodine goes right into the thyroid and kills it off. And that's just my own personal theory, but you know, there's a lot of people who share it. But nonetheless, the point is that this is something that, you know, she's going to take forever. And it used to be, you know, once a year, once every other year, come on in, let's just make sure that the dose is right, you know, that everything. You know, now it's more frequently than that. Yeah, same thing with you. And I think what we're seeing is a for-profit medical system that is operating in ways that are going to enhance profit. I mean, you know, it's just very simple. That's not to specifically indict your doctor, Rick, because I don't know
Nice
man. I don't know the circumstances. And with some people, as people age, it's more important to see them more often. But I've seen in my own life, and I've heard a lot of stories of similar things.
The other rationale they've used, or at least I've heard, he hasn't made this himself, but you know, they claim there's so many lawsuits that a doctor has to cover himself. Is that true?
Well, to some extent, yeah. It's really, frankly, very rare that anybody successfully sues a physician or a hospital for something that wasn't genuinely egregious. One of my very best friends down in Atlanta is a lawyer who sues doctors for a living. And, you know, I've heard some just god-awful horror stories. And they don't go after just, you know, random stuff. And when they do, they get slapped down. You know, that's true, but it's more of a canard than anything else. Mostly what you're seeing is an industry trying to increase its profits. Rick, I got to run. Thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as I move, the rubber's in the alley and the sun will be a suit. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone blue. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go.
And welcome back. You know, if you drink coffee, it should be fair trade, it should be organic, it should be from sacredgroundscoffee.com, and tell them we said hi. By the way, just a special tip, this Friday, 7 to 9 p.m., University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium, four of us on the left will be debating four guys on the right. Honorable Willie Brown moderating it, put on by Quake Radio, the Quake in San Francisco, the affiliate that carries this program, quakeradio.com, the website. You can download your free tickets. We need a big cheering crowd here, so if you're in San Francisco, go to quakeradio.com right now and download your free tickets for this gig. It's going to be a lot of fun at the University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium, Friday night at 7 p.m. And it'll be on the right, Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, Rusty Humphries on the left, Stephanie Miller, me, Rachel Maddow, and local progressive comedian Johnny Steele, moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown. So it should be a hoot. I just have to play from the weekend, and then I want to get Greg Gorman's take on it here. George W. Bush talking to Mr. Stephanopoulos here over the weekend.
James Baker says that he's looking for something between cut and run and stay the course.
We've never been stay the course, George. We will complete the mission. We will do our job and help achieve the goal, but we're constantly adjusting the tactics.
And that's
constantly.
We've never been stay the course, George. Don't you know it? People who say that are lying. In fact, here's Dan Bartlett.
So, Mr. Bartlett, staying the course is no longer the operative strategy?
Well, Hannah, it's never been a stay-the-course strategy. Strategically, we think it's very important that we...
It's never been a stay-the-course strategy. We've never said stay-the-course. Don't you get it? All those people out in the media who are saying that Dan Bartlett and Tony Snow and George Bush are in favor of staying the course, they're lying to you. We know that the American people are smart enough that they remember what happened and that they know that this would be a lie. It's, you know...
We will stay the course. We will complete the job in Iraq.
The second thing you do is you stay the course. But on the other hand, you also cannot be a president in a wartime and not realize that you got to stay the course.
We will stay the course. We will stay the course until the job is done, Steve. And the temptation is to try to get the president or somebody to put a timetable on the definition of getting the job done. We're just going to stay the course. And my message today to those in Iraq is we'll stay the course.
People are going to want more of it, and that's why the president's determined to stay the course, April.
And that's why we're going to stay the course in Iraq. And that's why when we say something in Iraq, we're going to do it. And so we've got tough action in Iraq. But we will stay the course.
But we just never really, you know.
James Baker says that he's looking for something between... Cut and run and stay the course.
We've never been stay the course, George.
Greg Garman, how long is this kind of stuff going to fly?
Is this the greatest stuff in the history of politics? I mean, this is a joke. This is an absolute joke. I'm sitting at my computer right now, Tom, and I just went to staythecourse.com just to see if someone had started a website where they count all the times that President Bush has said stay the course. Oh, it doesn't exist yet.
And somebody did?
No, not yet, but I guarantee someone should do it right now. It would be, I mean, this is such a joke. And Dan Bartlett has gone on every show. He's on the weekend show talking, we're not a straight to the court. I mean, I think it's absolutely incredible that the White House thinks that the American people are not going to buy or are going to buy this, you know, crazy, ridiculous rhetoric of, it's never been straight to the court.
Well, we've bought their lies in the past, so why shouldn't we?
Well, and that's sort of part of the reason why I wonder if people, you know, at some point, is this just one of those, I've got blinders on, I don't really care, I just, you know, I care that gas is $1.99 now. That's really what I worry, you know, about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know there's this new poll out, it's not a poll, over the weekend Barron did a story about, you know, with the financial slant, of course, which is, you know, what Barron's does. And they're saying now that according to what they're hearing and what they're reading and what they're polling, that the GOP will not lose the House or the Senate. So you know what, Tom? Maybe you're right. Maybe people are going to buy this. And if the president says it, then people buy it. I was in Atlanta over the weekend with a lot of people who were born and raised in Georgia. They love the president. They love W. They don't care what he does. They don't care what he says. They don't care how bad things are in Iraq. They love him. They have W's on the backs of their cars. Their eyes glisten over when they talk about him. Still.
Right. Because he is, he's Jesus' man.
He tells it like it is. You know, that's what they say. Well, now, all of a sudden, he's not telling it like it is.
Yeah, but they're not going to get that.
You know, I just don't think so either. And that's why I think this is absolutely incredible that the White House has the nerve to go on television all weekend and say, well, we're not going to stay the course. We've never been to stay the course. Someone needs to come out with a website, staythecourse.com. I'm throwing it out there now.
But that's not going to go to those folks in Georgia that you were talking to. You just said that there's a new poll out from Barron's that says that the Republicans are not going to lose the House. And this is what I've been saying all along. I've been saying that these guys, the game is rigged. That, you know, between redistricting, which they've been working on for the last 15 years, between purging the voting rolls, between the states where felons can't vote and using that as an excuse for purging, between the rigged voting machine, all this stuff, and which is not an argument not to show up and vote. I'm going to vote, and everybody needs to vote. I mean, if they're going to steal 4 million votes, we need to have 5 million people out there. But Barron says it.
Yep, that's what Barron says.
I'm going to have to track that. Is it over at their website, Greg?
Yep, I'm going to find it right now, and I'm going to email it to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's all right. I'll just go to Barron's.com and track it down. Greg Gorman, TalkRadioNews.com, the website. A lot of great stuff over at Talk Radio News' website, too. Check it out. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Thank you. 56 minutes, 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Coming up after the news, George Lakoff. His new book, Thinking Points, Communicating Our American Values and Vision. Stick around. It'll be fascinating.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So how do we communicate a progressive vision of America, or for that matter, how do we cause people to, Americans, to understand that the traditional values of America are progressive? That the founders of this country called themselves liberals, that the Enlightenment was a radical, progressive reframing of what it means to be human and what government means. How do we do all that? Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. George Lakoff is with us. Thinking Points is his new book, subtitled A Progressive Handbook's Progressive's Handbook, Communicating Our American Visions, Values, and Vision. George Lakoff and the Rock Ridge Institute. Dr. Lakoff, welcome to the program.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
So what is, in your opinion, the progressive vision of America?
Well, it begins with a vision of what a person is and should be. That is, people, care about other people. I mean, it turns out that physically we empathize. We are born with the capacity for empathy and caring about others. And the progressive vision says you not only care about others, you act on that care in terms of both taking care of yourself and taking care of others, having social responsibility. And from that, you get lots and lots of consequences. One is protection. So we have worker protection, environmental protection, safety nets, consumer protection, and so on. Others are the idea that people should be fulfilled in their lives, and to do that you need freedom, and to have freedom you need opportunity, and for opportunity you need general prosperity. Another application is in communities. You want to live in a community where you have leaders who care about you, who care about their citizens, who are responsible for their citizens, and where people care about each other and are responsible for each other in their community and work together. And that requires cooperation, which requires trust, which requires openness and honesty, and those are progressive values.
But the conservatives would submit to you, George Lakoff, that really this is a nation of Daniel Boones, that he's our archetype, the guy who puts on the coonskin cap and grabs his rifle and goes out into the wilderness and comes back 6 months later and says, hey, come on and visit. You can see the house I built. You can see all the furs that I trapped. You can see all the things that I've accomplished. I'm now, changing my name to Donald Trump and I'm a millionaire.
Well, it's simply not that way for two reasons, and let me go one at a time. Let's take taxation as a good example. Before the American Revolution, the king used to tax the colonists and use the money for himself. After that, they didn't get rid of taxes. What they had was a better idea. That is, you put together the commonwealth, they called their states commonwealths for that reason, the commonwealth for the common good to build an infrastructure so that each person could use that infrastructure to pursue his own goals. And, so they built roads and public buildings and hospitals and schools and so on.
And these days, what we have is an enormous infrastructure built on that commonwealth. We have the interstate highway system, the internet, the communication satellite system, but also the banking system. So if you want to start a business, you need a loan. You're going to have to go through the banking system. We have a court system, all funded by federal money. You're going to have your contracts enforced. You're going to need a court system, and 90% of that court system is corporate law. If you have the SEC for the stock market, funded by federal money, so you have a stock market that works. If you have made any money in this country, in business, you have not done it on your own. You have used the Commonwealth in every way.
In other words, we're a nation of barn builders, not pioneers.
That's
as much as we want to hang on to that myth of pioneers.
It's
I didn't say barn burners.
Builders. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, we build barns for each other. Yeah. And that's the point. Nobody is a self-made man or woman in this country. Nobody makes it on their own. We all use the Commonwealth. And it's not just taxes. The Commonwealth includes, our public lands. It includes our beaches. It includes all the things that we all own together, our atmosphere, the oceans, the rivers.
Our educational system, our police, our fire, our road. Yeah. See this, and I think most progressives and frankly most traditional Democrats actually see this, George Lakoff, author of new books, Thinking Points. And RockridgeInstitute.org is your website, isn't it? As I recall.
That's right.
Yeah. But there is a large chunk of America that just doesn't get this. That ever since, and I track this frankly back to the rise of the Reagan presidency in the 1980s, mm-hmm. and the war that went on in the 1980s that is being carried on even today by David Horowitz in the universities. It started first in our high schools of these socialist teachers, union member teachers are teaching civics as communism and the purging from our textbooks of discussion of things like the commons. And so we have two generations now that have graduated from high school without any idea of what you and I are talking about right now. How is it that progressives have failed to consistently over time communicate that vision, that message, and how can we begin once again to share it?
Well, there are, if you ask about the problem with progressives, there are many of them. One of them is, if you look at our leaders, our political leaders, they're stuck in a system of consultants who keep saying the same thing year after year because they get paid to do that. So that's one kind of issue. Another issue is the view of the Enlightenment itself. Most of our political progressive leaders went to college, learned about the Enlightenment, and half of what they learned was true and half of it was false. The part that was true is this, that we're all human beings. Part of what makes us human is that we all have reason, and therefore we don't have to ask somebody else to reason for us. We don't have to be governed by, religious institutions or the king or something like that. We can govern ourselves, and since we're all equally rational, the best form of government is democracy, and since it's irrational to be against your material interests, we should govern for the material interests of everybody. So far, so good. That's the basis of liberal democracy. The false part of this has to do with what reason is. And back in the 17th century, when Descartes set this up around 1660, he viewed reason as completely conscious. We now know from cognitive science that it's about 95% unconscious. He viewed it as literal, as just fitting the world, because God wouldn't lie to you. He would make our thoughts fit the world. It turns out it's not like that at all. We think in terms of frames and metaphors with our physical brains. Thought is physical, counter to Descartes. And thought isn't just logic. If you're against something, you just negate it, and it says the opposite. But in a system with frames and metaphors, if you negate something, you just reinforce the frame. So he does, all of this is just false, but the Democrats have believed the false part of rationalism as well as the true part. And so they get the idea that if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion. And that's utterly wrong.
So what do we do?
There's a lot to do. First thing, it's not that things are not going to change through our elected leaders, as good as they are, and I think they're very good. They're caught in a system that makes it difficult. What Rockridge is trying to do with Thinking Points is to expand upon it indefinitely, give it away for free, or whatever we do over the internet, but form a million voice, network of people who want to speak out. People who want to, you know, we can help them, we can give them tools for doing it, intellectual tools and practical tools, but we want to have people forming groups around the country to say what the progressive vision is. We can go through and give them forms of argumentation and so on. That's what Thinking Points does. I mean, for $10 you can go out and buy Thinking Points and it's all there. But the question is, how do you do it day by day, week by week? And that's where we can help. But I think it's got to be done outside of the party system, because people who are in elected office need cover. Bush never says a word unless it's been said 10,000 times before. And that's for good reason. If you're an office holder, you want to make sure everything you say makes sense when you say it.
Sure. And it's Goebbels' old formula of make it simple and repeat it often. It seems to work. George Lakoff, georgelakoff.com, a website also.
Don't go to georgelakoff.com. Go to Rockridge Institute.org.
Rockridgeinstitute.org. Okay, thank you very much. And the new book, Thinking Points, Communicating Our American Values and Vision. George Lakoff, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You can cry if you want to. You can rage at the night. You can blame all your wounds on the world if you like. You can drink from the bottle, no ice and no glass. You can lie in the morning and say it's your last. But you won't stop there. No, you won't stop there. You can tell yourself different, but you won't stop there.
Welcome to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. No RNC passes required. You won't be dragged off if you have a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker on the back of your car. You won't get arrested by the Secret Service if you speak, you know, if you tell me you don't like the war, or even if you tell me you do. Yes. Isn't it amazing what's happening in America right now? I mean, it's, and I don't mean that to be flip. We live in interesting times. We live in perilous times, and we are also seeing the blowback, the very, very significant blowback here. Barron's now, Barron's online. I just went in and read the entire article here during the last break. Jim McTague wrote this. It's called Survivor, the GOP Victory. It's going to be the cover story for this week's Barron's. And we expect the Republican majority in the House to fall by 8 seats to 224. At the very worst, our analysis suggests the party's loss could be as large as 14 seats, which still gives the GOP a majority in the House. And they say in the Senate with 100 seats, we see the GOP winding up with 52, down 3. And they say we studied every single race, all 435 House seats and 33 in the Senate, and based our predictions about the outcome in almost every race on which candidate had the largest campaign war chest. We ignored the polls. Thus, our conclusion about individual races often differ from the conventional wisdom. And then they go through, you know, how that is. But they just said it's all about the money. And it's interesting, as they point out, they say, is our method reliable? It certainly has been in the past. Using it in the 2000 and 2004 congressional races, we bucked conventional wisdom and correctly predicted GOP gains both years. Look at House races back all the way to 1972, and you'll find the candidate with the most money 93% of the time won the race. And that's closer to 98% in more recent years, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, which, by the way, is a liberal think tank. Polls can be far less reliable, they say. Remember, they all but declared John Kerry president on Election Day 2004. Well, he was, but that's a whole other thing. So they're just looking at the money, and they're saying, hey, the Republicans have a lot more money. They're going to win, period. They will carpet bomb with advertising at the last minute and change people's minds. And no matter what the Democrats say, the Democrats are, you know, over and over again saying, you know, blue, blue, blue. And the Republicans at the very last minute are going to come in. No, it's not blue. It's red. And they say it loud enough. They say it often enough. And they say it with enough media. And maybe they'll be successful. I don't know. I have been a contrarian through this whole process. I have always expected that the Republicans are going to hold control of the House and Senate. And I think it's possible that the Democrats can take control of the House and the Senate. And that's why I think it's so important that we give it our absolute best shot. But don't go down in flames if it doesn't happen. Because this is just the beginning. What's happening is the American people over the last 4 or 5 years are just starting to wake up. And that's really where the change has to happen, at the level of the people. So, Mark in Arcata, California. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm a conservative, and I have, you know, very conservative fiscal policy opinions, but I feel I've been totally lied to in that my leaders, who call themselves conservative, have really tried to redefine conservatism.
Yeah.
And then so the result is both sides of the aisle are telling their constituents that we're no longer an economically sovereign nation. So, and then they try and turn it into a liberal conservative issue, as if in the beginning the Constitution wasn't enacted for the purpose of regulating, you know, international financial interests who would exploit the sovereign economic nation of the United States.
And not just economic. In the Constitution, it also specifies between the states.
So there's an easy solution because, as you see, I as a conservative and you as a liberal have nothing between us in terms of economic sovereignty. We both will gain when both of us are living in a nation which, again, is economically sovereign. And the solution is simple. We can enforce the already, in effect, legal precedent of antitrust. It's
yeah.
not a secret that...
I agree. It was Reagan who stopped enforcing it in 1982. And that's what led to the mergers and acquisitions mania of the 80s and Michael Milken and all that stuff. And I was very disappointed in Bill Clinton when he didn't bring it back. Jimmy Carter was the last president to really enforce that when he busted up AT&T.
What I'm just saying is we need to write letters to our district attorneys, our state's attorneys, our U.S. attorneys, and our attorneys general, and just put on the pressure, because it's their job to enforce the law. There's clear violations rampant at the federal and even state levels of government. We need to put pressure on them as liberals and conservatives to enforce the law and become
I absolutely agree with you. And
thank
what
you.
That was, you're welcome, Mark. And what that will do is it'll open up space for small business, which is the real generator of economic growth and the largest generator of jobs in America, small business, to flourish, because small businesses are being killed by these giant monopolies. 27 minutes past the hour.
Was right and not political code. Where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me. The America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative. Katrina VandeHeuvel is with us. And, whoa, where'd it go? Here we go. Editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And what a weird echo we have there, Katrina.
Hope they're not tapping our phones.
Say hi to Alberto.
Maybe it's wavy gravy, or maybe it's the NSA. I don't know.
I don't know. It's welcome to the wonderful world of America now. I mean,
can you hear me?
I can hear you just
good.
Fine. Yeah, I'm just also hearing myself on a weird delay. In fact, the number one story that you had suggested we talk about today. This is our best of the rest of the news segment where we get on a prominent person in the media and talk about what's going on in the media. Is the death of America, the death of habeas corpus, the signing of this bill on interrogation and detainees?
This is a moment when, on the eve of this election, we have to look around this country and think about what is at stake as an administration has ignored our laws, has abused our Constitution, has relinquished the constitutional design of our country, which is as important as the physical security, and has done nothing to bring more safety or security to our country through this basically sanctioning of torture. Torture is un-American. And those, whether in the church or those in, who believe in the role of America in this world as standing for principles, which we claim to be fighting for in this battle against terrorism, are now seeing those squandered in those ugly photos of people, the president being one of them, flanked by members of Congress, by military, on the signing day last week.
Yeah, we're seeing the hyper-militarization of the United States, it seems. I just don't know how to describe it beyond that.
Part of this battle, Tom, this battle against terrorism, is about winning the hearts and minds of people in the world. And what is going on in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib in Afghanistan has brought shame, has tainted this country's reputation. It will take a generation or more, but it is a tragic moment. I think this administration, by the way, used torture as an electoral wedge issue. I mean, give me a second to explain what I mean. In 2002, this administration used the war.
And the creation of the Department of Homeland Security.
But they used that war vote, that war resolution vote, to basically railroad a country and mislead it into war. And in 2004, the security issue was working for the Bush White House. They wanted, they did well by it. They had security moms. They tainted John Kerry as weak and effete. And they come into this election, and the country, with not enough political leadership, but the country's turned against this bloody war, which has made us less secure in Iraq, and is also turning against the view that the White House is best at conducting the so-called war on terrorism. So they're now bringing out warrantless wiretapping, which is secondary, and the torture issue, and forcing a vote on it. And, with all due respect for people like Sherrod Brown, I hope he wins in Ohio. I think he's a decent man who will be a great senator. They force people like that to go on record, because to this day, people like Sherrod Brown are still afraid of being called soft on security, when in fact what needs to be explained is that torture, according to generals, according to those who have overseen such odious things as torture, you get unreliable information, and that's just the pragmatism of it, putting aside the morality of it.
Yeah, well said. Some of our callers are on the line with a variety of questions. It would be interesting to get your take on some of these things as well as mine. You mind playing talk show host with me for a few minutes here? Hello? Is Katrina still there?
Hear me?
Oh, okay. Yeah,
right
I can
here.
Hear you now. Okay. They must have been setting something up there. Okay. Let's go to Paul in Turner's Fall, Massachusetts. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. I reached a tipping point the other day, and I don't get uneasy like this very often, but I'm really concerned that with what you were describing as the hyper-militarization of the government, that the October surprise may actually be sort of a Gulf of Tonkin event, but happening in the Persian Gulf with Iran.
Mm-hmm. Katrina, what's your take on that?
The tragic October surprise at this stage, and maybe I would have said something differently a month ago, is that we now in this month in October have the highest number of U.S. fatalities in Iraq than we have had at any other point in this war since last November. And I think for this administration, that is the October surprise. And I don't want to demean the deaths of good men and women.
It's a negative October surprise.
October surprise.
But Barron's, Barron's right now just came out with this editorial. It's their cover story, in fact, for the October 23rd issue, that they're saying Democrats are not going to take the House or Senate, and they're just doing it based on who has the most money, and they've been doing that since 1978, and they're almost always right.
You're talking about that being an October surprise. No, but I mean, I think that we too often quote, you know, those who are opposed to what is being done in our name by this administration. Of course we're paranoid because we've had right to be paranoid. The election of 2000 was stolen.
We've had stolen elections before, so yeah, you were not paranoid if people are actually out to get you. Brian in Orange County, California, you're live with Katrina Vandehuvel and me. What's
hey,
up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, Katrina. Good to be speaking with you. Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I was listening to what you said about the Barron's will, and I'd be curious to find out if this, the previous times when they've done this based on the funding and when it's been, they say, oh, it's almost always right. I'd be interested to see what percentage of those times the polling supported that theory and what a number of times.
Usually they say it didn't. They say there were two anomalies in 1954 or 56 during when Eisenhower was Republican and was president, and we were in the midst of a very bad recession. They said that the numbers versus polling didn't work out quite right, and Republicans lost a lot of seats. And during Watergate. But those are the two exceptions. And they say that right now the level of scandal doesn't rise to that of Watergate. So you had a question, Brian.
I did. Well, I think that this is something that we can turn around. And I guess I'm looking more for an idea of, you know, am I on the right track, or is this just kind of wishful thinking? Because my thought is that, you know, sort of in spite of the money, this can still be done because, you know, partially because one of the things we have now, we haven't had since, you know, certainly since 1978, is the Internet. And we are able now to sort of cross district lines. You know, you mentioned the MoveOn.org, you know, Call for Change.
TheNation.com.
Yeah, callforchange.com. Yeah. That's something we can actually do. A lot of people are actually writing a lot of letters to the editor.
Right. So, Brian, we're getting tight on time here. The question for Katrina is...
Well, my question is that can community involvement, can stretching out and the level of activism that we have right now, is that something that can overcome this fundamental, you know, difference in
the structural
funding?
Differences that range from redistricting to enormous amounts of cash?
I mean, the redistricting is a serious issue, but yes, organized people versus organized money, that is our hope. And organized people comes in many new ways now, and the Internet. And let's all fight to keep the Internet open and free. And you know,
although the right wingers are using it too. You know, I sent $5 to the GOP about 5 years ago, and I just got a solicitation to do 2-hour phone bank from the, you know, to get on their mailing list. And they are incredibly organized on their get out the vote.
Why is it that the GOP is usually at the forefront of attempts to suppress the vote? I mean, that is documented by scholars and people who study voting patterns, and we're seeing it now play out with this voter ID stuff.
Well,
but I'm just saying that I think that, of course, the Republicans have learned how to do that 72-hour project, get out the vote.
Sure.
They have more money. But there is the possibility through organizing, through the Internet, through community involvement, through organizations that to overcome those impediments. And of course, the other thing we haven't really talked about is, you know, the voting machine issue is one that we must all be attentive to. I do not believe that is the only problem with our voting system, which I think a lot of people do. I think it is a central one.
No.
And if
the
Democrats take back the House, there has to be make this the civil rights issue of our time, that there is a paper trail, that there is really a whole democracy promotion movement at home, because we go around the world preaching democracy when our supply of democracy has been quite depleted at home, and we need a lot of attention to the contours of our democratic system.
Yeah. And in fact, you asked, you know, why are the Republicans at the forefront of suppressing the vote? Here's Paul Weyrich. You know who Paul Weyrich is, the Republican strategist?
The Republican guru, sort of direct mail ideological
architect. He's the guy who claims that he got Reagan elected. I mean, he's been around forever. Here he is talking in a church to a group of Republicans about this very issue.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
That was 15 years ago.
Well, there you have. I mean, there you hear it straight out. No need to embellish that.
Yeah.
But we're, you know, yeah.
Can you stick around over a break, and we can pick up a few more calls and wrap this stuff up, or do you have to run? Katrina. Hello?
Hi, I'm
You said yes. Okay, I'm sorry. They're potting you down when I'm talking because this echo is coming back and it's going out on the air. So great. Yeah, stick around and we'll take a couple more calls and we'll see where we can go with this thing. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. We're talking with Katrina VanderHeuvel, TheNation.com, the website for The Nation magazine. And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartmann here with you. Katrina VanderHeuvel doing the same thing in print over at The Nation magazine, thenation.com, their website. And Katrina, let's see here. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. You have a question for us?
Well, yes. And Katrina, you're a hurricane of fresh air. I'm calling about Mr. Lakoff's Don't Think of an Elephant thesis, because he was on before. Do you think that the authoritarian model has had such a long-term influence that it has affected liberals, too? I'm talking about those people who believe that there should be a social net, but when it comes to policies like free trade, they take that triangulation position. So they're conciliatory to the right, but when people who are truly affected by those economic policies legitimately say, well, why vote for Democrats when they go along with Republicans and
like those, the so-called, you're talking about the Tom Friedman liberals.
Right, those guys. then they go ballistic and spastic with that punishing, authoritarian approach toward people they perceive as more liberal than they, and they're anything but conciliatory. So do you think that that is that long-term influence, or has it always been that way?
Are we all being brainwashed, Katrina?
I happened to this country in the last 10, 15 years is you've had a kind of hijacking, and I say this with measured words, a hijacking of a political process by extremists, so that you have a Grover Norquist, who's a guru to the White House, talking about bipartisanship is another name for date rape. It's really a moment where I think a lot of decent people in this country want to have a real politics, not a downsized politics of excluded alternatives, and want to hear some sanity. And I think that's being excluded, and it's a need to get our bearings. And I believe, just coming back to the greatest disaster of these last years, that is the war in Iraq, that people want a sensible, principled foreign policy that will make them secure, not a messianic crusade that's going to deplete this country's blood and treasure and build the threats against us. So I just think we need to get our bearings. I don't know about the authoritarian mindset, but I do know that we need real leadership, and we also need real activism from below to make this a better country, and it is a better country than it's acting at the moment.
Yeah, well said. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're live with me and with Katrina VanderHeuvel.
Yeah, hi. Hey, Tom. Hi, Katrina. On this Barron's prediction of the GOP holding Congress just because simply of money and carpet bombing of advertising the last few days, I see a silver lining and some hope for the Dems. The Barron's forgot to count the carpet bombing of CNN's series in the last 2 weeks called Broken Government, which is free money for the Dems of carpet bombing them back.
Well, in a way, though, there's a meme to broken government, which is, you know, it's the same thing that the Bushies have been doing for a long time. They break the public schools, and then they say, look at this is broken. We need to privatize it.
No,
they
but I think
break, you know, Hurricane Katrina. They say, see, FEMA doesn't work. You know, government's not a decent solution.
Yeah, people see it's Republican government, and I think, well, that's the silver lining that I see.
Is that people will say Republican government. Yeah, go ahead, Katrina.
Tom, I think you made a very wise point. I think what's happened, it is true that there's enormous corruption in Congress. It is true that government failed this country during the Hurricane Katrina. But if you have people running a government who hate government, who want to strangle government and drown it in a bathtub, as one of their leading ideologues said, then you're gutting government in the process, and we need to restore a sense of the necessity of effective and smart government. And I gather from your callers you've been talking about this Barron's series.
Yeah.
I watch these crazy Sunday talk shows. Sometimes I go on them, but I have to say, watching Meet the Press yesterday,
there were some savvy, smart people, don't agree with all of them, but who, like Charlie Cook, mm-hmm. who really thinks you're looking at a House takeover, and it may be a question of 20 seats, or it could be 25.
You know what was amazing about that, Katrina, was every single one of the people on that panel throughout the entire segment on Meet the Press was talking about the Democratic takeover of the House as a disaster, as a bad thing, as a negative, we're unhappy, this is going to hurt. All of the metaphor was the Democrats taking over is going to inflict pain. And I think in part it was because most of the people on that panel were, you know, Republicans or conservatives. But also the subtle message that was conveyed to America is if the Democrats take over the House and or the Senate, it's going to be a painful thing.
Played into, you're exactly right, Tom. It played into the scare campaign that the Republicans are banking on in these last days. It's ridiculous. I mean, the Republicans are going on about Nancy Pelosi, John Conyers, and Charles Rangel as something out of a Halloween movie, as if they're going to do anything more dangerous than raise the minimum wage, you know, and repeal this Medicare legislation.
Well, they may have
beat the government from lowering drug prices by negotiating with drug companies. Come on. I mean, yeah.
But they could charge a few Republicans with crimes, like violating the FISA law, for example, and Bush and Cheney get marched off in irons, or get subject to impeachment, actually, would be the immediate constitutional remedy.
I mean, the thing that really does need to happen is you need to have about 10 oversight committees running at full speed and full strength. And you know what? You got Henry Waxman investigating war profiteering. The power of oversight, of checks and balances, is going to also allow some missing ideas to come into our political system, which have just been excluded these
Absolutely.
Last years.
Absolutely. We have to have an opposition party with the power of subpoena. Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, thenation.com, the website. Check it out. Katrina, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great speaking with you. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative Matt Moore and I will be heating up the airwaves as we each predict the liberal and conservative vision of what's in store for the 300 millionth American just born. And Bob Borisage is going to be dropping by on Hacking Democracy. That and more in your calls right here. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.